Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
And on Sunday nights, you're with me, Noel Debien, and sitting in for John Cleary. And joining us now from the United States, Ted Olson, Managing Editor from Christianity Today. Ted, good to be speaking to you again.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Noel.
Ted, I've been leafing through this month's magazine, and I have to say, my eyebrows were raised when I saw what had happened at Vanderbilt. Now, this is the university, I think, in Tennessee, yeah? And it was once, I think, very early on, affiliated with the Methodist Episcopal Church before there was a fight with the trustees, so it had a Christian background.
Right, absolutely, as did, you know, most of the university system here in the States. Most private colleges were, you know, church-affiliated at some point in time.
And what I've seen is there's an article in Christianity Today by Tish Harrison, who's an Anglican priest from the Anglican Diocese of North America, pointing out that the Graduate Christian Fellowship basically has been deregistered and kicked off campus. Now, what's happening?
Well, this is a problem at a number of schools across, you know, the students are returning to classes this fall. But across the country, a number of these chapters of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship have, over the summer or as the last year waned, were told that they would no longer be recognized as campus groups. Vanderbilt was one of the most prominent fights, but in previous years there have been other fights at some fairly, you know, big schools. In a lot of those cases, InterVarsity was able to come in and negotiate some sort of agreement with the school. But right now the tides have turned. InterVarsity is being told you can no longer meet on campus, you can no longer identify yourself, you can't use the word Vanderbilt in any of your names or publicity materials. You can't have any advertisements on campus. Can't you know, have access to certain student facilities.
So just to get this straight, though, I mean, EU would be well known in Australian universities, big evangelical
union.
Yep. There would be, you know, the Newman Society would be the Catholic version. There would be the Jewish Union of Students. There is Islamic Student Association, all with creedal beliefs. And the thing that's at issue here at Vanderbilt is they've basically told the Graduate Christian Fellowship that you've got a creedal system of beliefs and that's exclusive and therefore we won't register you. Am I reading the article right?
Right. Essentially, the real issue where it came down is that InterVarsity wants to be able to require officers to adhere to the group statement of faith. So they have a creedal statement. In the case of InterVarsity, which is part of this larger global network, the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, it's a pretty bare bones evangelical creed. You know, you're not going to have a whole lot in there on the particulars of hell or on it. A bit like the Nicene Creed, with you know, maybe a couple of further explanations.
A belief in the Bible as the Word of God, for example, something like
right.
that.
Yep. Yeah. And the issue is for the campuses, they say, no, if you are requiring your officers to adhere to the group statement of faith, you're discriminating on the basis of religion. All of these club positions have to be open to everyone, regardless of what they believe. And, you know, the schools or the clubs are saying, you know, this doesn't make any sense. Does the Democrat club have to allow a Republican president? But they say, no, you know, religious discrimination is a real concern. So you're no longer allowed on campus. It's particularly amazing that it's happening to InterVarsity, given that, you know, InterVarsity does not have a reputation for being, you know, a real firebrandish or aggressive evangelical organization. I mean, this is a group that largely is book studies. It's definitely one of the more progressive or academically minded student Christian groups on campus. And that was in the article you referenced earlier by Tish Warren. Yeah, that was kind of one of her main surprises. Was she said, "Well, wait, we're the right kind of Christians. We're the kind of Christians that you want on campus." And yet, she was a bit surprised that you know, even being the kind of nice, tolerant Christians by having this statement of faith was they were dismissed. And it's become a really big issue just in the last few weeks, because the entire California State University system, which is the largest higher ed system in the United States, They have said no InterVarsity chapters are allowed at any campuses this year.
Well, what's got me scratching my head, though, is Tish Harrison is a woman Anglican priest. Therefore, we're clearly not talking the most conservative of Christian groups. It's a woman Anglican priest arguing that their group has been basically told you can't come on campus because you have defined religious beliefs that won't allow anybody to take office in your organization, and therefore the university won't actually license you and allow you to use the university's name. It would amount to the same thing being done to Evangelical Union in Australian universities. You're not allowed on campus anymore. You can't have a standard orientation day. You can't do any of these things. Is this really America we're talking about here, Ted?
It is a little bit surprising given America's reputation as being a Jesus freaks wherever you go. But, the higher ed system is kind of the point of the plow. I mean, it's the edge of where you have the questions of how do you integrate people who have strong religious beliefs in a campus that wants to be, tolerant. What does tolerance look like? Can you tolerate a group that says we want to associate around these beliefs, and we want the ability to say if you're president and you suddenly decide to become an atheist, that you can be dismissed. I mean, that really is what InterVarsity is most concerned about, is leaders who, when they're elected, they have one set of views, and then it's college. You know, a lot of us change our views in college. Later on, change their views, and they could, of course, derail the entire club, which could be thousands of students.
Well, you could knock me down with a feather. Look, just staying on that Jesus theme, I saw another piece by Kevin Emmett, Seeing Too Much Jesus in the Bible. Again, a surprise. My eyebrows went up. And this was a story where Douglas Green, who's a professor of Old Testament and Biblical Theology at Westminster Theological in Philadelphia, has fallen afoul of the college because he was seeing too much Jesus in the Old Testament, basically. Admittedly, he was talking about the Psalm of the Good Shepherd and identifying the sheep with Jesus as well as the shepherd with Jesus. But he's basically been told, no, this doesn't hold with Biblical theology for us.
Right. It's an argument that can get a little deep into the weeds, but it is a question of how much can you read the Old Testament with the view of Christ being the center of it. Christian scholars all believe that there's some element of Jesus in the Old Testament. This particular scholar was arguing that the traditional evangelical approach kind of doesn't go far enough, that we need to see a number of Old Testament and read a number of Old Testament passages. We need to see Jesus kind of everywhere in it. Oddly enough, Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd," was the passage that really well known. And he says, when it's talking about, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death," that is talking about Jesus, walking through the valley of death to the cross.
Sounds reasonable.
Right, where most people would say, in this context, Jesus is the shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd who takes care of me and helps me lie down in green pastures. It's more of a approach of how you read the Bible than the specific of saying Jesus is the sheep. But they say, if you start to say, Jesus is the sheep. David was not thinking of God as himself. He was thinking of Christ kind of leading him through this. And so you don't want to mess with what David was thinking when he wrote the psalm too much.
My mind immediately jumps to someone like Amy Jill Levine and thinking, well, wait a second, I'm sure that David, when he was writing about the Lord being my shepherd, had no mention of Jesus in his thoughts or in his conception, that this is something prefigured, as it were, they call traditionally, and then we look back and say, of course, this makes sense. So where is the line if you're going to say the Hebrew Testament has integrity and Douglas Green has gotten in trouble here?
Right. And, the school was very careful not to say, he's a heretic or he's, damaging the faith or whatever. But they did say, we are Westminster Theological Seminary. We're this kind of Calvinist Reformed school that has these long documents. And they say, the way in which you're treating the Bible here severs the link between the Old Testament and the New Testament, kind of downplays the union of human authorship and divine authorship. And then so they said, we don't want to, cast you out, but we would like you to revise your views here. Green being somewhat near retirement, but not anywhere, not planning to retire anytime soon, said he didn't want to change his view. So they said, well, why don't we work it out so that you retire in 2 years? And given the choice between retiring in a year and revising his views, he said, well, I'll take early retirement, I suppose. So you know, it is this being pushed out. And it is interesting to think about, you know, the debates in the evangelical world about how, and in the entire Christian world, about how the view that God, you know, inspired the Bible, including the Old Testament, and the human authors, you know, David clearly wasn't thinking of this Jesus person who would come along hundreds of years later, but was envisioning a Messiah. And where can you put that Messiah image, you know? And how important is it where David would have thought of the Messiah in context as he was writing? Green's view is we need to have a second reading that doesn't take into as much of account what David was really thinking about. We need to come back through and kind of not dismiss it, but have a view that makes David's conscious thinking a little bit less important in our Christian reading of it.
Well, it does strike me, 2014, where, you know, we're getting on to a long time since the scriptural arguments first kicked up. Was it the Marcionites? So you said the Old Testament was of the devil and we were throwing that out, and only the New Testament was to be read by Christians. And we've come into an era now of the last 100 years where scholarship in Hebrew Testament is paying attention to Jewish scholarship. And of course, we're trying to say, I think, well, Christians are trying to say, we need to look at the intention of the authors. But then there is this line about Christians look at the Hebrew Testament and say, this is ours, and the New Testament is somehow a fulfillment, is what some would say, not supersessionism, I mean, but is somehow you can only read the New Testament in relation to the Old and vice versa, a Christian would say, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I think for evangelicals, there's a big thing going on too, where, you know, I know as I was growing up, the Old Testament was kind of where you got moral stories, you know. Here's a story about obedience. You know,
the Ten Commandments.
And even the kind of the lesson of the stories was, you know, obey your parents in this one, or trust God, or, you know, some of those things. And I think within the last 10 years, there's been a larger focus to say, well, let's maybe have a more of a grace-filled view of the Old Testament, or a little bit more of a what does the Old Testament tell us about God, rather than what does the Old Testament tell us about behavior. And I think because I think that's a good conversation to have, and I think that's an extremely important conversation to have, but the nuances of how you're going to have that conversation, they're fairly fraught, and they also get people really cranked up, because a lot of these old debates, whether it was, you know, Marcion saying the Old Testament doesn't matter, or whether it was the fights over last century over, you know, naturalism and the role of miracles and all those things. People drag in some of the old fights with liberalism. People drag in some of the old fights over. And a lot of those old discussions inform when people are trying to do interesting biblical scholarship from an evangelical view right now.
Alive and well at Westminster Theological and at Wheaton College, clearly. Let's go to some of the human drama going on. I think Mark Driscoll and megachurch meltdown. Tell us what the latest is.
Sure. So I don't know how many Australians are familiar with Mark Driscoll, but he is probably one of the most prominent megachurch pastors in America. Not necessarily pastor of the largest church, but certainly a media figure. Probably you know, one of the most controversial.
Sure.
He's definitely a love him or hate him kind of person. He's kind of been the icon of kind of masculine Christianity here in a lot of ways. And also you've seen in the last 10, 15 years, him kind of come in from a kind of an angry young man in a lot of ways. And a lot of that history has come back to bite him lately.
We religion and ethics tragics here have been following the story here. And this, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, this was a story where he was trying to understand, he was trying to explain the complementarity of men and women and the way God had designed them. Is that where we tripped up?
Yes, he was big into men should be real men and women should be, you know, real women who largely help and complement
helpmates,
men.
Exactly, as
helpmates,
as the Hebrew Testament indicated.
Right, so that's where a lot of the controversy has been historically. But in the last few weeks, he has stepped down, at least temporarily, from his Seattle church. There have been a number of charges brought against him, not, you know, like law-breaking charges, but, you know, church charges. A lot of it basically boils down to bullying, My Way or the Highway, and the way in which he talked about people who disagreed with him. So what's going on there doesn't just raise questions about pastoral leadership and the kind of the demeanor that you need to, you know, pastor. The questions that this raises about megachurch governance. Mm. You know, a lot of the megachurches are independent, or they create their own kind of family of churches. Mm. So within the Mars Hill conversation, there's been a lot of argument and confusion about, you know, whether the role of the church board is to care for the senior pastor or whether it's to care for the congregation.
Right. So it's broader governance issues this has brought up as well.
Right, absolutely. So, and a lot of the problems kind of came to the fore as Mars Hill really pared back its board and said, the board is really going to focus on the care of Mark Driscoll. Now, you may remember Ted Haggard, who was megachurch pastor here as well. A similar thing happened kind of in his meltdown, although that was much over, you know, sexual ethics and issues. But the board issue was the same. It was like, well, we have a board here who's been kind of created to make sure everything goes well for our kind of founder, leader, pastor. Mm. And in that case, and in this case, the board kind of suddenly said, you know, our responsibility really isn't to this senior pastor as much as it is to the congregation, but we don't have kind of a history or a...
And under American law, it would be, too, to the broader, of course, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And then also, I think, you know, one question when you have these mega, mega, mega independent churches is, you know, who's fit to be on the board of an internationally prominent mega church, you know? Mars Hill had kind of created itself to do what kind of a business or, you know, or I guess what a nonprofit or a business would do. And it says, well, we need, you know, outside experts, you know, the best in the world or the best in the country who are going to be good on finance issues or leadership issues. So they brought in, you know, a lot of other megachurch pastors to be on this board. But, you know, traditionally a small independent church is going to largely have a board made up of people within the congregation. Mm. So there's a lot of discussion about, in a big church context, is it best to have an outside board, people brought in from the outside to help govern, or is it best to still have people who are within the congregation governing that church? Of course, you know, in a lot of other contexts, whether you're talking about Presbyterians or Anglicans or whatever, you know, church governance issues were settled, you know, centuries ago. But megachurches in a lot of ways are reinventing the wheel.
And oddly enough, the Vatican itself is going through this very same process with the Vatican Bank and Governance, and they've snatched the Archbishop of Sydney to do it. Ted Olson, it's great to talk to you again. Christianity Today, a great read again this month. Thanks for joining us on Sunday Nights.
You bet. Thanks, Noel.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.